Translation. In that planet of Satyaloka, there is neither bereavement, nor old age, nor death. There is no pain of any kind, and therefore there are no anxieties, save that sometimes, due to consciousness, there's a feeling of compassion for those unaware of the process of devotional service, who are subjected to unsurpassable miseries in the material world. Purport. Foolish men of materialistic temperament do not take advantage of successive authorized knowledge. The Vedic knowledge is authorized and is acquired not by experiment, but by authentic statements of the Vedic literatures explained by bona fide authorities. Simply by becoming an academic scholar, one cannot understand the Vedic statements. One has to approach the real authority who has received the Vedic knowledge by succession, as clearly explained in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, text 2. Lord Krishna affirmed that the system of knowledge, as explained in Bhagavad Gita, was explained to the sun god, and the knowledge descended by disciple succession from the sun god to his son Manu, and from Manu to King Shivaku, the forefather of Lord Ramachandra. And thus, the system of knowledge is explained down the line of great sages, one after another. But, in the course of time, the authorized succession was broken, and therefore, just to re-establish the true spirit of the knowledge, the Lord again explained the same knowledge to Arjuna, who is a bona fide candidate for understanding due to his being a pure devotee of the Lord. Bhagavad Gita, as it was understood by Arjuna, is also explained, but there are many foolish men who do not follow in the footsteps of Arjuna in understanding the spirit of Bhagavad Gita. They create instead their own interpretations, which are as foolish as they themselves, and thereby only help to put a stumbling block on the path of real understanding, misdirecting the innocent followers who are less intelligent, or the Shudras. It is said that one should become a Brahmana before one can understand the Vedic statements. And this stricture is as important as the stricture that no one shall become a lawyer who has not qualified himself as a graduate. Such a stricture is not an impediment in the path of progress for anyone and everyone, but it is necessary for an unqualified understanding of a particular science. Vedic knowledge is misinterpreted by those who are not qualified Brahmanas. A qualified Brahmana is one who has undergone strict training under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. The Vedic wisdom guides us to understanding our relationship with the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna and to act accordingly in order to achieve the desired result of returning back home, back to Godhead. But materialistic men do not understand this. They want to make a plan to become happy in a place where there is no happiness. For false happiness, they try to reach other planets, either by Vedic rituals or by spacecraft, but they should know for certain that any amount of materialistic adjustment for becoming happy in a place which is meant for distress cannot benefit the misguided man, because, after all, the whole universe with all its paraphernalia will come to an end after a certain period. Then all plans of materialistic happiness will automatically come to an end. The intelligent person, therefore, makes a plan to return home back to Godhead. Such an intelligent person surpasses all the pangs of material existence, like birth, death, old age, and disease. He's actually happy because he has no anxieties of material existence. But as a compassionate sympathizer, he feels unhappiness for the suffering of materialistic men, and thus, occasionally, he comes before the materialistic men to teach them the necessity of going back to Godhead, going back home back to Godhead, and warn them not to make a false plan for happiness in a place where happiness is only a myth. Om Gyan Jivanandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Vritanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivastava Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. You are in the section of the Bhagavatam in which Sri Shukadeva Goswami is describing the gradual path back to Godhead. There are two ways, the direct path and the indirect or gradual path. Shukadeva Goswami has heard this from Brahma. He's going to say later in this chapter that what Lord Krishna told Brahma, I am telling you. Brahma had this knowledge impregnated in his heart. Tene Brahma Hridaya Adikavaya. He's the Adikavi, the original scholar of the universe. And the Lord taught him personally Vedic knowledge in his heart. But still, Shukadeva Goswami is going to reveal, Brahma studied the Vedic knowledge three times just to set an example for everyone that I'm studying, I'm concentrating my intelligence on this knowledge, you should also do the same. Even though I as Brahma have had this knowledge enlightened within me in my heart by the Supreme Lord, still I'm studying. And Shukadeva Goswami is saying, I'm presenting you that same information. What are you going to do about this information? Do you really accept that there's a such a loka, a topmost planet of the universe where there are no gross bodies, the living entities exist in subtle bodies, and the only anxiety they feel is because of compassion for those suffering on the lower planet? What do your imperfect senses tell you? What does your mind tell you? How can you really accept this? The Bhagavatam is apparently full of so many statements that challenge your mundane understanding and sense perception. Why blame it all on the Bhagavatam? What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Imam vibhasvate yogam proktavan ahamadhyam vivashvan manavik. I spoke this knowledge to the chief living entity who lives in the fire, on the planet of fire, the sun planet, the president of the sun planet. I spoke this knowledge. So right then and there, you had your chance to reject Bhagavad Gita. I wonder how many of you think about all these things that Krishna is saying. First you have to cope with Bhagavad Gita, and then you get the wonderful opportunity in life to cope with Srimad Bhagavatam. And now you're hearing information that your senses have no ordinary cognition of. What to do? Earlier we heard explained that for any kind of knowledge, material or spiritual, you have to rely on authority. Therefore, the quality of your life will be defined by the quality of authorities from whom you accept knowledge. So you have to compare. You have to compare the behavior and consciousness of someone like Shukadeva Goswami with the behavior and consciousness of mundane authorities of today. Even in this ordinary world, you'll find so many things that challenge your understand it. I was recently speaking in New Dwarka, Los Angeles, in January, and there I was explaining to the devotees that New Dwarka community is full of senior Prabhupada disciples. They're very mature, experienced in the world. Yet, I told them something that I didn't realize would astonish them. I explained how I was speaking in Cape Town, South Africa, at the University of Cape Town. Cape Town is a very balmy place. It's a big tourist destination now in South Africa. Palm trees, pleasant breezes, beautiful views of the mountains and the sea and the beaches simultaneously. All the residents there are very laid back and content to varying degrees. So there I was speaking at this university, and nowadays universities in South Africa have all types of bodies. So there were some, along with the Europeans, or South Africans of European descent, there were some African Africans from the neighboring country of Botswana. So they were from wealthy families, very intelligent, very refined in behavior, very cultured. And they began to ask about Krishna consciousness. So I invited them, after our gathering is over here at the university, please come to our center nearby and we'll discuss more. So they did that. They came by later that day. And before they came, I decided, let me do a little geographical research. What is Botswana? What is life like there? It's just north of South Africa, I believe, a neighboring country, 1.5 million people. So I researched on the internet. What did I find? The average life expectancy is 32 years. So when these students came over, I told them, excuse me, but you've got to take this opportunity very seriously. Because, how old are you right now? 20, 21. According to statistics, you can expect to live 10 more years. Yeah, some of you are laughing, but they very gravely accept it. We know this is true. The national average of lifespan in our country is 31 years, 32 years. The women are get one more year. If you look at the official statistics for lifespans throughout the world, on top is Japan, Singapore, 83 years, the USA is 77, and way down in 191st place on the list is Botswana, way down the bottom, 31 years. So, the students, they accepted this. Yes, we know. We understand. They accepted it as a basic fact of life. So when I spoke this in Los Angeles, the devotees were shocked. Scores of them came up to me after class. How can this be true? This is impossible. Because the verse we were discussing in class was about extraordinary lifespans on different planets. The lifespan of Brahma, all which is inconceivable to our ears, but that's just material knowledge. But devotees in sunny Southern California, bordering Hollywood, they were shocked. They said, how can this be true? Actually, younger devotees were more emphatic. How can I accept this? There's a place on this planet where people only live to the age of 31 as their national average? How can this be so? Their senses rejected it. Such a difficult time believing. I had to show them. Here are the statistics. Then their minds were pacified to some degree. I showed them some mundane authority. Oh, okay, Maharaj. So there you have an example of an ordinary fact of this world, and Americans were astonished. know what is myth? How do you know what is not myth? How do you know who to believe? How do you know who not to believe? Here you're learning about Satyaloka, the planet of Brahma. The Shastra describes that even if you go to Brahmaloka, if you're not a demigod, or if you haven't taken fully to the process of bhakti, you'll fall down to the lower planets, lower than Brahmaloka. If you are a demigod who's finished his tenure as Indra or whatever, then you'll go to Brahmaloka, and when at the end of Brahma's life he goes back to Godhead, if he's a devotee, and in this particular universe Brahma is a devotee, then you'll go back with him. But if you're not with that group, even though you're on Brahmaloka or Satyaloka, you'll go down again after you expend all your pious activities. This information is given by Rupa Goswami and Laghu Bhagavatamrita. So, this is all unverifiable by your present senses. Who are you going to believe? I'll give you an example which may either help you or confuse you. Now, whether or not you are concerned with did anyone go to the moon or did they not? Who knows, it could be just ISKCON mythology. It could be just the most Prabhupada said that. In any case, without going into that, let me give you the authorized statement of the sixth man who says he walked on the moon. He says he did. I'm not. He says, I've walked on the moon. Number six, Edgar Mitchell. Now, do you believe it? He says it. Almost all the world believes. He's the authority. He is an astronaut. In the USA, to be an astronaut, you are a deva. You're at the peak of physical prowess, intellectual prowess. You are the Mahajan of the nation. So this is who we're going to hear from now. He says, I was there, I was on the moon. He believes that. What is his educational background? I'll tell you later, after I tell you what else he says. You see, this is how you get into trouble, trying to accept mundane knowledge. If you're going to accept, as most of the world does, that he walked on the moon, you also should accept the rest of the things he says. He says, I know for a fact there are aliens, there are UFOs, I have seen the governmental evidence, I know the government is covering up, there are private industries which used to be under the government control, which are developing technology which they reverse engineered from recovered UFOs. All this is going on. I know it for a fact. I've seen the documents due to my military clearance, due to my stature as an astronaut. I was allowed to understand these things. Many government officials are tired of the cover-up, but they're afraid if the news gets out, the people will panic. If the news gets out that there are entities on other planets, the people will have breakdowns. So therefore, the government is doing them a favor, according to its perception, by keeping everything hidden. So now what are you going to do? Are you going to say, we accept that you walked on the moon because you said it, but we don't accept this stuff about, aliens and UFOs? Because, well, not many people accept that, but everyone accepts what you said about walking on the moon. So what do? Do you accept everything he said, nothing he said, one or the other? What is your mind's predilection? Which path does your mind choose? Now, let us hear about the stunning, erudite, materialistic qualifications of this astronaut Mahajan. PhD from MIT, the supreme destination for scientific research. PhD in aeronautics, astronautics, plus two other honorary PhD degrees, decorated with the finest military medals, commendation, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and assorted other Navy awards, Army awards. Yet this is what he's saying. Now, what are you going to do? If you say, Edgar Mitchell is sure he walked on the moon, everyone will nod their head. Even many or some of our devotees. Or why he died. I still think he did. But what about the other thing he says? This is the pitfall of dealing with material authorities. All his words were published overseas in Europe, but very little in the USA. The news media blacked him out. And meanwhile, you have the former head of the defense ministry in the UK, and you have former generals and national chief of police in France saying, we know the USA is covering up, and we're going to use the EU to pressure the US to stop repressing information about this. Who do you believe? Now let's hear about such a look. Why should your mind reject this? Just because it's something beyond the range of your immediate verification? We are hearing from Shukadeva Goswami. When you understand the character and the lineage of Shukadeva Goswami, then you'll trust him. And that lineage is so important. I wonder how many of us truly understand the importance of the nature of the succession and how knowledge comes down. Krishna himself stresses this in Bhagavad Gita. Evam parampara praptam. Imam Rajasya Vidu. Vidu, how did they understand it? They understood this knowledge. The Rajarshis, the saintly kings, understood this knowledge through the simple succession. In other words, there is a process for how to learn things. There is a process for how to understand, and if you want to understand Bhagavad Gita, you have to accept that particular process. Right in the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the most exquisite Vaishnava literature, Srila Prabhupada writes in the first purport, I believe, of the first verse, that anyone who doesn't accept the process of the Sutta succession cannot understand anything that's going to come in the pages of Chaitanya Charitamrita. Impossible to understand. They may be the greatest scholar, they may be the greatest academic, but unless they have taken shelter of the parampara, they can't understand. Now, how does that sit with you? Does this seem just like some Hindu taboo? Oh, you have to be lined up with a certain party, you have to be affiliated with a certain line of teachers, and then you can understand. That's not very contemporary, is it? The contemporary mentality is, you can understand whatever you want. Go to the bookstore, get a book, go online, do some research. You'll understand everything. It's all the understandings are available to everyone. You don't need to purify yourself. You don't need to have a qualified teacher. You yourself are enough. It's amazing how, no, it's not amazing, but it's typical in Kali Yuga, how this attitude can affect even our own devotees. That is why it's so important to absorb yourself in a concentrated study of Srimad Bhagavatam. For example, here in Mayapur, you have the Bhakti Shastri program. I've heard from so many devotees who have studied Bhakti Shastri here in the holy atmosphere of the Dham that their lives were transformed by 3 or 4 months of daily full-time study of Srila Prabhupada's books. They said it just turned their whole life around. Why? Your life will become transformed when, one way or another, you deeply accept these principles, these sacred principles of the Shastra, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. You have to think about these things and allow your head and your heart to be challenged. And that's how you experience spiritual growth. Srila Prabhupada was expert in doing that on his morning walks. He would challenge your conceptions. He would challenge your assumptions. And then he would insert the real knowledge that Lord Krishna gives. Once we tame our ferocious mundane minds, then we can taste the sweetness of Srimad Bhagavatam. And tasting the sweetness of Srimad Bhagavatam means tasting the sweetness of knowledge about Krishna, Krishna Tattva, knowledge of Krishna's pastimes. Just like Shukadeva Goswami is giving you a tour of the universe, Lord Krishna also gives his tour. Other saintly persons, besides Shukadeva Goswami, they give their tour. In the seventh canto of Bhagavatam, Prahlad Maharaj and his confidential associates go on a tour of the universe. And what are they looking for? What's their form of sightseeing? They're looking for the loka tattva, the truth about various types of persons who live in the world, particularly the truth about those advancing in Krishna consciousness. This is Prahlad Maharaj's idea of sightseeing. He gathers his friends and says, let's go toward the universe and see the different types of sadhus, the different types of Krishna conscious persons. They did that, and they came upon the python there, who's performing Ajagara Vritti. He's taken the vow to just lay in one spot like a python and accept to eat whatever comes his way. So Prahlad saw this man. He's a sadhu. He's a great devotee of the Lord. Yet he's fat. How can he become fat? Just by lying in one place. Prahlad began to question him so eloquently, so precisely, that the python man felt the words of Prahlad Maharaj to be like a shower of nectar. He didn't feel challenged. If someone asked you, excuse me, why are you so fat? You would feel a bit offended, probably. But the python man was captivated by Prahlad's presentation that I can see for sure that you are an extraordinarily realized devotee. At the same time, don't mind me saying, but you're fat. Can you kindly explain this? And indeed, the python man did. He gave Prahlad Maharaj's history, that I have seen the way this world works. I have seen what happens when people believe in material happiness. Just like Prabhupada ends the purport here by saying, all the bona fide acharyas preach this truth of returning home back to Godhead and warn men not to make a false plan for happiness in a place where happiness is only a myth. Now, what do you say about that? You're living in a world where happiness is only a myth. Do you really believe that? Or maybe this is all myth, this information you're getting. You're challenged. Do I really believe that material happiness is simply a myth? It doesn't exist. While Prahlad was touring the universe, the python man told him, that is a fact. I have seen it all. I have seen people do everything to pursue material happiness and simply suffer through anxiety so much that they can't sleep at night. I've seen it all. I've seen man and woman come together to enjoy the so-called happiness of sex life, and all they get is trouble. I've seen all that. I've seen the distress that comes from economic development. Therefore, my conclusion is to just not participate in karmic activity. I'll just lay here and accept whatever comes my way. In other words, the python man is teaching us that material happiness is a myth and the spiritual reality in Krishna consciousness is factual. So that's that experience, that knowledge you're getting by the grace of Prahlad Maharaj, because he's taking a tour of the universe and authentically presenting to you what he saw, what he heard by way of the python man. Lord Krishna Lord Krishna also gives his tours. In Vrindavan, 11 days after the Govardhan Leela, Dwadashi, Nanda Maharaj wanted to take bath in Jamuna River in order to complete his vow. But there's some technical point about whether it was the right time to take bath in the Jamuna River or not. A technical point about when Dwadashi actually ended, when the night actually ended of Dwadashi. So anyway, Nanda Maharaj and his friends, the elder cowherd men, the gopas, they went to the Jamuna River, and as Nanda Maharaj was bathing, he was taken away, as you know, by a servant of Varuna. Immediately the gopas cry out, "Krishna, Rama!" Krishna is sleeping on a bed of flowers, the acharyas say. And immediately Krishna came, because Krishna is always nearby. It's not a question of physical distance. He is inseparable from his Vrijavasi devotees. So the Lord asks, "Which part of the water did my father disappear in?" The cowherd men pointed. Krishna entered the water and that way went to the watery kingdom of Varuna. As soon as he arrived at Varuna's kingdom, Varuna offered so many wonderful prayers and greetings. "Now my life is successful. I have taken thousands of bodies, but at last my body is successful by seeing you. There's so much wealth in my watery kingdom, but now I have finally obtained the real jewel. I'm seeing you." "My Lord, you are the ocean of forgiveness, and I am the ocean of offense. If you desire, you may punish me. Here is your father." Krishna can see that Varuna is worshipping Nanda Maharaj. Nanda Maharaj is seated on a jeweled throne, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And who is Nanda Maharaj worshipping? He's just thinking of his son Krishna. The Lord takes Nanda Maharaj and they return to Vrindavan. Naturally, what is the first thing Nanda Maharaj does? He begins to tell all his gopas, his cowherd men, "I can't believe it, what I saw. Varuna is worshipping my son Krishna. And all of Varuna's servants, they're worshipping my son Krishna." Then it's time for Vrijavasi philosophical speculation. The cowherd men began to consider, "You told us before that your son was like Narayan. Now we can see he is Narayan." Sometimes, by the arrangement of Yogamaya, the residents of Vrindavan can understand Krishna is God, but the amazing thing is, this understanding that Krishna is God in the heart of Vrindavan does not in the slightest way disrupt their rasa. They had no problem maintaining their particular rasa with Krishna, wasn't disturbed in the slightest. Whereas when Vasudeva, after Krishna killed Kamsa, when Vasudeva saw Krishna and Balaram approaching him, treating him as father, he could not reciprocate. "You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're not really my sons." Similarly, Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, after he saw the universal form, he begged Krishna's forgiveness. "I treated you so casually, lying on the same bed, eating with you, acting in a relaxed way with you." But in Vrindavan, even though at that particular moment, the Vrijavasis, the older men, are thinking Krishna is God, they are undisturbed in their spontaneous affection for the Lord. So then they decided, "Let's do some interesting explorations." if, and we now know it's true, your son is God. And the Acharyas, they added some village familiarity to it all. Your son is God, and don't forget, we're related to your son, we're related to your wife, we're related to you, it's all one big family. Since your son is God, he should show us what our destination will be in the next life. In the Krishna book, Prabhupada explains that Krishna was very eager to impart information of the spiritual world. The Lord is like that for everyone, not simply his intimate devotees, but for the conditioned souls. He wants to teach them there is something beyond this miserable place, the material world, where happiness is only a myth, a place that is planned for misery. So Krishna eagerly wanted to show them. He asked them, okay, what do you want to see? They all had different ideas. Some said, I want to see liberation. Others said, I want to see Vaikuntha. Krishna said, very well, come with me. They went to a particular lake, and there the Lord submerged them all in the water. And as they submerged themselves in the water, they could experience Brahman, Brahman realization. Sayuj Mukti. Now generally, if you've gone into Sayuj Mukti, oneness with the Lord, how do you come out of that into bhakti? But because Krishna was doing this, they were able to experience Sayuj Mukti and then rise up because of Krishna's orchestrating the whole scene. Next step on the tour, next place on this scenic tour of the various transcendental locations, the Lord showed them Vaikuntha. He gave them a complete vision of the Vaikuntha plan. Then, within showing them the Vaikuntha plants, the Lord showed them Goloka Vrindavan. What were the comments of the cowherd man? This place, this final place you're showing us, it's just like our place. It feels the same. It tastes the same. In this way, Krishna showed them there's no difference between Goloka Vrindavan and Goma Vrindavan. The Lord showed them the superiority of Vrindavan, its praying, compared to merging into Brahman, compared to Vaikuntha. Krishna also gives his tours. Shivadeva Goswami gives his tours. Prahlad Maharaj gives his tours. Later, at the end of the 10th canto, the Lord shows Arjuna, Mahavishnu Loka. You know how Arjuna promised to save the son, the newborn child of a particular Brahmana couple, and he failed. So Arjuna had vowed, if I can't save your newborn baby, I'll enter into fire. So, time for the birth of the child came. Arjuna protected the situation all around with arrows and mantras. Still the child disappeared, and Arjuna's arrows disappeared too. The Brahmana ridiculed him right in front of Krishna. If Aniruddha, Pradyumna, so forth couldn't protect my son, how can you? And then he hit Arjuna with the ultimate insult for a kshatriya. You're a eunuch. So, Arjuna had taken the vow, I'll enter into fire unless I can save your son. So Arjuna searched the whole universe, even up to Satyaloka, and he didn't find the child. Prepare to enter into fire, and then Krishna stops it. Come with me. They got on Krishna's chariot with his Vaikuntha horses, and they went through the coverings of the universe, They went through impersonal Brahman. They went all the way to Mahavishnu Loka. And as they approached Mahavishnu, lying upon the body of Seshanath, Krishna and Arjuna offered obeisances. Mahavishnu did not return the obeisances, because Mahavishnu was acting in his way to preserve the sanctity of the Nanalila, the human-like pastimes of Krishna. So, the Acharyas say that Mahavishnu conspired with Krishna. Let's bewilder Arjuna, and then at the end we'll all reveal everything. So Mahavishnu said to Arjuna and Krishna, "You are my parts." You see, this chapter began with an inquiry, who is superior, Brahma, Vishnu, or Shiva? And Bhrigumuni made this test, which established that Vishnu is superior. Now Shukadeva Goswami is describing this pastime of the Lord and Arjuna visiting Mahavishnu to show that Krishna is superior to Vishnu. But at first, Mahavishnu says, "You're my parts. I've always wanted to see you." And Krishna offers his reverence to Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu gives the child of the Brahmana to Krishna and Arjuna. They take him back to Dwarka. And at first, Arjuna is thinking, "I have seen Mahavishnu, the cause of all causes. I have seen the source of everything. By Krishna's grace, I've seen the root of it all." But then he begins to wonder, wait a minute. Although Krishna is offering respects to Mahavishnu, and Mahavishnu didn't return the obeisances, and although Mahavishnu says that we're his parts, why did he say he always wants to see Krishna? He always wanted that opportunity. Something's not right here. Then Arjuna began to meditate on the actual situation. Obviously, this whole incident came about because Krishna is superior to Mahavishnu. The only way Mahavishnu could have the darshan of my beloved Lord Krishna was to take this Brahmana child, and in that way, he could get to see Krishna. Krishna and his holy Dham of Dwarka are so powerful that Mahavishnu couldn't even come to Dwarka to see Krishna without Krishna's permission. This is the supremacy, the super excellence of Krishna. And Krishna's devotees are so extraordinary that Mahavishnu could not send a servant of his to take the Brahmana's boy. He had to do it himself, because Krishna's devotees, his Brahmanas, are so dear to him. All this unfolded just so Mahavishnu could see Krishna, who is superior to him. So then Arjuna presented his conclusions to Krishna, and Krishna said, "Yes, that is so. And actually, I did not go to see Mahavishnu simply to get the son of the Brahmana back. It was not necessary for me to go through that. For that purpose, I went to see Mahavishnu with you to save you, my dear devotee, from entering into the fire." So in this way, Krishna establishes the supremacy of Swayam Bhagavan and also the supremacy of his devotee in relation to him. These are various tours of the universe available to you in Srimad Bhagavatam. First, you rid your mind of materialistic conceptions implanted so deeply by materialistic authority, and then you can become saturated with the pure spiritual conceptions of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. You'll be able to hear Lord Chaitanya talk about Krishna's opulences to Sanatana Goswami and have his mind absorbed in the Aishvarya Sagar, the ocean of opulence. And then you'll see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu become overwhelmed by the sweetness, the Madhuryamrita, the nectarian sweetness of Krishna's intimate characteristics. And he'll explain about Krishna's body, Krishna's face, Krishna's smile. And finally, Lord Chaitanya will conclude saying, "Wait a minute, Sanatan. I didn't plan on speaking about Krishna's sweetness. I was simply going to explain to you about the opulence. But Krishna wanted to shower his mercy upon you and make you aware of his intimate characteristics. Therefore, regardless of my plan, I spoke to you all these things, even though it can seem that I'm a madman. You have gotten that mercy from Krishna. You have heard about Krishna's sweetness. All this information is there for you. Don't be afraid that it will take you at least a lifetime to relish just one drop. That is your wealth as a devotee of the Lord in parampara." Lord Chaitanya said, even the Aishvarya Sagar, he can't explain the length and breadth. Just one drop is beyond your comprehension. And just one drop of the ocean of sweetness can drown all the three worlds. So this is the information you have for absorbing your whole life. Because it's coming through parampara, you will get realization, simply if you're patient and determined in devotional service. I will ask if you have any questions. Yes?
Thank you very much. I wonder what happened with this Samadhi in the Sangha. Krishna gave it to Yuvaswami.
What happens to that knowledge?
Yeah, and also to the knowledge that Arjuna got it. If there's some sampradaya arise, and also what about the four sampradayas that come from Brahma, and were they not there at the time?
Krishna says, "Sakkalenaha yogata yoga nashta parantapa." Because of the time factor, the purport, the real purport of Bhagavad Gita was lost. That doesn't mean the book was lost, doesn't mean the Sanskrit was lost, it doesn't mean the text was lost, whether oral or written down. It means the clear purport was lost because of the effects of time. You see, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna doesn't cover up. He lets you know there are problems in this material world. Even the meaning of Bhagavad Gita can become lost, and I come to speak it again. Sometimes even in a spiritual organization, because it's operating in the material world, there are problems. We're not utopians, Srila Prabhupada said. We are realistic about the nature of this world, and Krishna explains that in the Gita. Sakkalenaha yoga nashta parantapa. Because of time, the way things work in this world, the original purport of the Gita was lost. But I come to speak it again. Other questions? Yeah.
Very good. Thank you for the very nice lecture. Maharaj, I was wondering if you could help me both to understand. You know, in the beginning of the purport, it says that the loka is actually a place where there's no misery and there is no fall down. And there is also a quote in the beginning of the fifth canto that says that Satyaloka, there is no birth, no old age, no disease, no death. And there is another quote in the ninth canto. Now, the question is this. On the other hand, you have Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita who says that Prabhu down to Navavar Pinotriyan. Says, you know, that from the highest planet of Lord Brahma down to the lowest, they're all placed in miseries and suffering, and where old age, disease, birth, and death are succeeding. Now, I was wondering if you can reconcile this apparent contradiction.
There is no gross bodily existence, so there's no gross bodily birth, death, old age, or disease. But there is fall down, according to Baladeva Vijayabhushan, in his commentary to Bhagavad Gita. Those who go to such a loka and they're not retired demigods. They're not pure devotees. They will, when their pious activities are suspended, they'll fall down to the lower planes. So, you'll hear more information tomorrow about the bodily type on Satsaloka, the nature of the subtle body, and then you'll also hear how to go beyond Satsaloka, because this is Shivadeva Goswami's presentation of the gradual path, how to go beyond Satsaloka to the spiritual world. On that gradual path, Mahavishnu Loka is an intermediate stop. So you'll hear more about that in the coming days. But yes, you can fall down, even from the highest planet, if you're not fixed up in bhakti. If you're fixed up in bhakti, you go back to Godhead with Lord Brahma. And the descriptions of Satyaloka are not in reference to a gross material body, a gross material birth and death and old age. Anything else?
Another question about this fall down process only. You say that the pious activities have all been exhausted. The jiva immediately falls down from there and comes on the earth and comes into the grain and then which is eaten by a human being and comes into the semen and all that. So I wonder sometimes that the semen count, an average human being, is 150 million. Which four individuals semen count is taken produce the entire world population in the space of 10 days. So this is something which I don't make sense of. Can you please help me raise this?
Could not catch.
He's saying that the average semen count, in other words, the average male has so many sperms, all of us have souls.
Mm-hmm.
And he's thinking that they're all coming down from higher planets and they're eaten through the grains and absorbed into the body.
Human form of life is a junction. You can attain human form of life by coming down or coming up. And once you get the human body, you can go down or you can go up. So it's not simply that you get a human body by coming down. You can also come up from lower levels. We can talk more about this later, though. I can sense you want to get into the detail. Thank you very much, Swami Rajasura.